Hello, everyone. My name is Michael Auslan, and I am the Payson J. Treat Distinguished Research Fellow at the Hoover Institution, specializing in contemporary Asia. And I would like to welcome you to Hoover Capital Conversations. The Hoover Institution is a preeminent research center whose mission is dedicated to the principles of individual, economic, and political freedom, private enterprise, and limited representative government. In this series, we'll be discussing policy with policymakers. Capital Conversations brings Hoover Fellows together with policymakers for informed, in-depth discussions on some of the most vexing problems facing our nation. By bringing together the key players in the development of policy and the execution of policy, we hope to enrich the landscape of ideas, ask bold questions, and seek powerful solutions to improve people's lives. Today, we'll be talking with General Charles Q. Brown, Jr., discussing his strategic vision for the U.S. Air Force: accelerate, change, or lose. As part of the discussion, we will be taking audience questions and encourage you to submit yours at the Q&A button located at the bottom of your screen. Let's get started. A fighter pilot, General Charles Q. Brown, Jr., is the current Chief of Staff of the United States Air Force as of August 2020. Serving as the senior uniformed Air Force officer, he is responsible for organizing, training, and equipping the 685,000 active duty, guard, reserve, and civilian forces serving in the United States and overseas. And as a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he functions as a military advisor to the Secretary of Defense, National Security Council, and the President of the United States. General Brown, we thank you for 35 years of dedicated service, and we welcome you to this conversation.
Hey, thank you, Michael. It's a real pleasure to be here, and I know you're back there in Washington, D.C. I'm out here in California at Vandenberg Air Force Base visiting and really looking at our nuclear enterprise. It was part of the reason I came out here. But I'm really looking forward to our dialogue today and the questions that will come from the other participants.
Well, thank you, sir. Why don't we just delve right in and let's start with your strategic vision for the Air Force. The paper that you released upon becoming chief, Accelerate, Change, or Lose. No one doubts that we have the finest Air Force and the finest airmen in the world today. Why then do you feel that if the Air Force doesn't accelerate and change, we could lose?
Well, you're right. We have the finest, most respected Air Force in the world. That is a true statement. And of course, I'm probably a little biased about that. But the aspect I think about is as we move forward, there are those that watch us and want to be like us. And as you do that, whether it's your allies, partners, or your adversaries, there's aspects, particularly when your adversaries are starting to make advances that challenge your advantage, then you need to stop back and take a look at yourself, look in the mirror and look at what we are doing. And because of that, then I've, over time kind of watched how we have operated as I watched our, what's happening around the world. And I think the key aspect that would kind of highlight this for us is a national defense strategy that came out in 2018. And one of the questions that, as I've talked to folks, is when that national defense strategy was written, who was that for? Was it for us? Or for our adversaries, our allies and partners? I think a little bit of both. And part of it was a wake up call to go, we've been really focused on violent extremists over the course of the past 20, 30 years for the Air Force to go all the way back to Desert Shield, Desert Storm. The Air Force has been in the Middle East. With that then, if you're gonna do great power competition, you need to start really thinking through that. And as I watched over time and having a lot of time in the Middle East, I started to see the aspect of our competitors starting to gain on us a bit. And I really also realized that if we don't start looking and taking that into context of how we operate, how we think, how we acquire capability, that erosion will actually just occur and naturally, and then we'll wake up one day and go, what happened? And so part of this to me is a wake up call to the Air Force and how we take a look at ourselves, but it's also how we work with and collaborate with our policymakers, work with industry, work with Congress, work inside the Department of Defense. And so what I really felt like is if we didn't start changing, there was things we had at risk. And what I really focused on is, how we compete for great power competition, how we look at a high-end fight, how we look at our quality airmen. You know, if we don't change and if we don't keep pace with the times, they're going to look for more attractive career choices. And then I'm also worried, naturally about our national security. And so that's a key aspect. Why I talked about change, though, is also the fact there are several factors that are driving us to change. The stand-up of the U.S. Space Force, that came out of the Department of the Air Force. So that's driving change within inside of our department. So that's one factor that helps to accelerate. COVID is another that is actually making us do some changes. Racial disparity is driving us to do some changes. Just the geopolitical environment's driving changes. So, part of this is there's a lot of things that are making us change anyway. Why not use this as an opportunity to accelerate that change and also talk about what's at stake?
Thank you, sir. Let me throw out a date for our audience, April 15th, 1953. That's the last time a U.S. troop on the ground was killed by enemy air fire. So essentially, for 70 years, we have had dominance of the aerial domain. Given the problems that you saw in the Middle East, but certainly that we know are in Europe and the Pacific as well, can you explain to us what it means for the U.S. military to try to operate in an environment where the skies may be or are contested?
Well, the skies are much more contested than they've have been in the past, and that's why this whole aspect of accelerate change or lose, how we look at the future design of our Air Force, so that we can actually maintain what we've had since 1953, air superiority and air dominance. The aspect of that, it's being challenged. And it's something that, particularly when you're doing a violent extremist fight where they don't have necessarily an air force, then we're not as threatened. And so what we don't want to do is assume away or just think that it's a American birthright that we have air dominance. And so we have to invest that. We have to actually think about it from an aspect of not the way we've been operating in the past, but how we need to operate in the future. One analogy I would give to you, I had the distinct privilege to be the air component commander for United States Central Command and a key aspect of the Defeat ISIS campaign. And it was really about a couple months after I took the job, the Russians came into Syria. There's a pretty dense integrated air defense network that the Syrians have. And I talked that we were flying permissively in a non-permissive environment. So they had all the capability to actually challenge our air superiority, but they didn't have the intent to do so. That's the thing we had to think about. There's a lot of capability out there from a surface to air, but also with ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, and those capabilities are advancing and are not very expensive compared to some of our capability. And those are the things that they hold us at risk. And this is why air dominance, air superiority are so important, so that we can have as a joint force with our allies and partners, have the freedom of maneuver that we've become accustomed to. We just can't be in a comfort zone and just think it's always going to happen without us thinking about how we invest in the future.
It's amazing if you think about it, there's no one with living memory of a time when we didn't control the skies, no one in the Air Force, no one in the United States. And so we've made these assumptions, as you said, sir, that we can go wherever we want. Those are changing. Let's talk a little bit more, if we can, about the document. In fact, for our audience, if you look at the chat function, we've put up a link to the chief's paper. You can download it from the Air Force website, and I highly recommend you read it. Given the challenges that you've just talked about and the fact that they are very cost effective for adversaries and less for us, the need for change, in your vision, how does the Air Force look different tomorrow, meaning in the future, whether it's 10 or 15 years, than it does today? What goes away? What do you have to divest? What do you add? What is the specific changes that you begin to see on that landscape or airscape?
Part of this is how we do some of our own processes inside the Air Force. And one of the things we had done in the past is we had our people with the money, our people with our plan kind of all together. So the folks that had the money kind of drove the plan. We were able to separate that out under General Goldfein and set up the Air Force war fighting integration capability. And now we have our planners who look at our future Air Force and our money people kind of separated so that you can build a plan, not think about them. You have to think about the money, but starting out, you build a plan that's going to provide us the capabilities we need, and then look forward about how you fund those. You know, part of the key aspect of this is we also need to be thinking about more about the capability and less about the platform. And so that's the thing about our Air Force. We're a very technical force. Those that know us tend to look at our technology, but also take a look at our platforms, and we're specifically airplanes by and large, and weapons. And so we tend to talk about those, but we don't forget about the complete capability. And that includes, you know, I've got to have the airplane, the sensor, the weapon, the manpower, the intel, all that stuff has to come together in order to be effective. And so this is where we're really looking towards our future Air Force. And a key aspect of that is advanced battle management system. And it's the aspect of being able to use all the data. So it's really more about being looking at data, looking at being more software focused and how we move information, how we design future capability, and taking advantage of the capability that we, you know, the design and manufacturing capabilities that many of us see in our day-to-day lives, how that comes into the Air Force. And so as I look to the future, we will be more of a digital force. We're moving information matters. And so you can be light, lean, agile. And it's not so much about the number of platforms, it's about the capability those platforms provide based on the information and the data you're able to move. And so that's a key aspect. So it's really thinking differently about how we operate. And then on top of that, we also need to take a look at, we can't buy very exquisite and expensive equipment, you know, when our adversaries are buying and outnumbering us with less expensive. So we got to think differently about how we do this. And there may be some ways that we can actually do things that are less exquisite, less expensive, but have the same effect, particularly when you have the information and data to make the decisions and they all kind of come together. And it's really a different approach in how we've acquired. And this is something we're trying to work with our industry partners with as well, that we're all in this together.
Well, I think there was a report recently that, in fact, in relative secrecy and with relative speed, the Air Force actually may have put together a sixth generation fighter prototype. Is that something you can talk to us about and tell us, you know, how that sort of fits in with your, we've just said about working with industry, but doing it in a way that it's not, you know, it's not going to be $250 million plus per unit of plane, but it's going to be something we can afford.
Right. Well, the aspect of this next generation air dominance, it's less about the airplane, but it's more about the concept. And the concept is to be able to, using digital technology to design and build more quickly. And you know, there's examples of this in the commercial sector. In this case, this particular platform has actually flown, but if you're able to use the digital, and so that, you know, the major builders of the all have the same digital plants. And when everything comes together, it's kind of snaps together. You can do it very quickly and you can kind of plug and play capability. It's less about what we build, it's how we build. And now we can be much more adaptive, much faster. And it goes back to, if you think about, and our chief of acquisition, Dr. Roper's talked about the digital series aircraft we had in the late 50s and 60s, the same kind of construct where you're able to build fairly quickly and adapt based on what you're seeing from our adversary or what technology becomes available. So we're not building something that's we're gonna keep for 30 to 40 to 50 years. But by the time we get it in the hands of the warfighter, the software is a decade old. And so it's the aspect of how we're able to use that digital technology to move faster, very similar to what we see in the commercial sector. The aspect here is it's going to change our approach of how we do this for the Air Force, but it's also how we work with industry. And we all need to be moving in that same direction. And I see aspects of that. And the next generation of dominance is one way that we're able to prove that some of this can work and will work.
As an aside, we had General Mike Holmes, the former commander of Air Combat Command, visited us at Stanford last year before everything locked down. And it was fascinating what he was talking about. The Air Force has always been a leader on the cutting edge of technology, but some of the things he was talking about were things that seemed out of science fiction, you know, basically spraying and then growing airfields, air landing strips that you can do anywhere, that you don't have to have the type of labor intensive approach that you had before, which gives the Air Force incredible flexibility, all these types of things that you're talking about certainly seems connected to a lot of what we talk about when we're talking with our partners in Silicon Valley. How strong is that relationship between the Air Force and Silicon Valley and those who are driving the digital revolution going forward?
I think it's getting stronger and stronger by the day. And part of this is it's the aspect of, if you're familiar with the term AFWorks, where we've actually set up different aspects across the country and building relationships with non-traditional industry partners. So it's not the major companies, but it's maybe the smaller companies that at some point the behemoth of the Department of Defense and, you know, all the paperwork we might require makes it very difficult for a small company to come in and approach us. We're really trying to open the aperture and kind of flip the script in some aspects. We're able now to work and really walk them through the process and get them in the door. By doing that, they see an opportunity. We also see an opportunity as well. And it's also the aspect of some of the things we're able to do might have applications in the commercial sector. And I'll use Agility Prime as a good example. You know, folks have said, why does the Air Force need a flying car? Well, we can use it for logistics for one, but you actually have other parts of our commercial sector that could actually use this to move capability, whether it's equipment, maybe people, packages across the nation. We've already seen some of that and on the news, just the very basic. But the aspect of this is, how do we partner up with various small companies, venture capitalists that are pursuing technologies that we're both interested in, and how do we make it better? And then it actually has a commercial value, but it also has a national security value. And part of this is just being able to talk to each other and getting past some of the kind of the barriers and hurdles that have been somewhat traditional. And I think we've been working really hard to kind of break those down and open up and really build relationships as we go forward. The Space Force is doing that. It's a separate service now, but the aspect that they're able to do some of that in our space launch capability is another good example. And that's the way I'd say both the services, both the Air Force and the Space Force, are heading down that path.
If you're just joining us, I'm Michael Auslan. This is Hoover's Capitol Conversations, today with the Chief of Staff of the U.S. Air Force, General Charles Q. Brown, Jr. Sir, immediately before becoming chief, you were the commander of Pacific Air Forces, and so you're uniquely qualified to talk about what may be the greatest national security challenge we face, both as a nation, as a military, and as an Air Force, which is China. Could you talk a little bit about the Air Force's role in the larger U.S. Indo-Pacific strategy?
Sure. The first thing I would share with you, Michael, is the fact that I don't know that we as an Air Force and a lot of sectors fully understand China. We'll pay attention to, and this is a technical force looks at a force technically. And what I mean by that is we kind of pay attention to, what type of airplane they have, how many airplanes they have, what missile, how far does it fly, how many rockets do they have, those kinds of things. We need to really start broadening our and deepening our thinking about, how the PRC, the People's Republic of China, operates, how the People's Liberation Army Air Force operates, how they think, how they make decisions. So it's really us deepening, and this is where one of the things I've done is laid out to our, I had four priority areas, and one of those is looking at competition and how we deepen our understanding. And by doing that, when we actually execute and fly and operate and exercise with our partners in the region, we have a better sense of how that contributes to competition, how it better contributes to assurance and deterrence. It's easy for us just to go fly someplace and not think twice about it, but it may be an opportunity to better assure and to better deter. Because the goal is written in the National Defense, right? Our job is not to go to war. Our job is to maintain stability, a free and open Indo-Pacific. And if we don't understand that, we may upset that balance because we do something unbeknownst to it, that triggers something, or we're asleep at the switch when things are going on and we're not doing the right indication or warning. And so with our intel surveillance reconnaissance capability is one way the Air Force contributes to kind of be paying attention and reporting that information at the same time as we operate to better understand how our operations impact the decision making, how it impacts influence, how it builds partnerships in the region. I have some really good personal relationships now with a number of the air chiefs in the region. And those relationships really, really do matter. I mean, it's amazing. Matter of fact, just this past week, I spoke to both the Singapore Air Chief and the Australian Air Chief on broader Air Force issues. But the beauty of that, I knew them from when I was sitting there in Hawaii and engaging with them in the region. And it's those relationships that that matter. So that's the way the Air Force helps. But we also need to understand that we're just one part of a whole of government approach of how we operate in the Indo-Pacific. And if we don't understand that, we could be, you know, stepping on our own toes and not helping out the government at large, as well as our allies and partners in the region.
Sir, when you were commander of Pacific Air Forces, you used to put up a pretty scary slide that showed the 2025 comparison between what the PRC would have, the PLA in total, and then us and our allies. And as you would say, we're behind, you know, we're falling behind in terms of sheer numbers, not in terms of necessarily the quality of course, of our forces and our training. But how do you, are you worried, you know, at some point, as friends always say, quantity becomes a quality of its own. And to what degree are you worried that as an away game with very limited forward-based forces, though extraordinarily well-trained, it's just hard for us to keep up the commitments that we've made in the Pacific?
Well, you know, I guess the reason we're accelerate change or lose is I want to not get to a point where I'm really worried. I want to, you know, be more proactive than reactive so that I can actually highlight the fact that there's some things we need to do. And, you know, there's others that are written as well, where I've seen, you know, various op-eds, various books where this topic has been addressed. You know, the first, we got to get past talking about it and then thinking about kind of how we do some of these things. And it's really changing our mindset. And it's, you know, for us as an Air Force being lightly and agile, how we pre-position capability because of the distances that we might have to deal with. But it's also how we build the relationships in the region so we don't get a position where we got a bit of worry. I will just tell you, from my engagements in the region, as I talk to our partners, I think we all kind of see it the same way. We don't want to go to conflict, but we are also paying attention to what's going on. And the more we are working together, the more we are able to highlight where we're working together, that helps us in the, it helps in deterrence value, but it also helps in assurance value. And then it makes sure, you know, the Indo-Pacific region is a very strong economic engine. And we're very much as a nation, very much intertwined, as well as many of the nations in the region, as well as China. And so we want to make sure we're paying attention at so we don't kind of fall by the wayside as we're working in the region. So that's a key aspect of the, as I see the Indo-Pacific and you know, the importance and how the Air Force can contribute is, you know, one, our understanding, but also how we build the relationships within the region.
Thank you. To our audience, if you haven't submitted questions, we actually have a ton, but you can submit questions at the Q&A button at the bottom, and we're gonna move into that now. We're gonna try to get to as many as we can. But I'm now in this section, I'm actually gonna take the prerogative of asking you the first question, even though I've been asking questions. There are a lot of important and controversial questions we could ask you, General, such as why you prefer the Marvel Comics universe to the DC Comics universe. But let's ask something even more important, and that is a question I've actually been able to ask a number of your predecessors and a great number of friends who fly in the Air Force, many who are general officers. And that is, if you could fly one fighter from any era of aviation history, which fighter would that be?
P-51.
That is 100% the answer every single time I've gotten from General Welsh and General Breedlove, General Carlisle, a whole bunch of people. The P-51. Any reason why the P-51, sir?
The Tuskegee Airmen. They're the reason why I'm here, and it's been pretty interesting. Really, in the past week, I've had the chance to engage with three documented original Tuskegee Airmen: Charles McGee, Alexander Jefferson, and Harold Brown. And I had a couple different events where I had a chance to engage with them, and just listen to them talk. And if you don't mind, I will share a quick story.
Please.
Mr. Jefferson, we asked them, I had some ROTC cadets with me, and we started asking them about their experience in combat. And Mr. Jefferson kept talking about Colonel B.O. Davis and how he came to them and said, failure is not an option. And he said it probably six times in the probably hour we were together. And it just really, it was almost like B.O. Davis talking to me. It was, and that really, you know, it was really impressive for me because if anybody ever comes to my office, I've got a number of Tuskegee Airmen type memorabilia throughout my office. And it's just, it's something that I've, followed throughout my career. I just get, I get goosebumps when I have a chance to talk to them. And then just to think about flying the P-51 and put a red tail on it, God, that would be awesome.
For those who may not know as much Air Force history, General Benny Davis, the first African-American general officer in the Air Force, a pathbreaker and a leader and mentor to so many in the Air Force. Thank you, sir. I'm great. I'm very happy we could have that story. Let's get to a bunch of questions. We have so many, and I'm scrolling through them here. We do have a number from Arik and Nick and others that basically ask, can you talk a little bit about the mix that you foresee for manned and unmanned aircraft? So with pilots in inside the cockpit versus remotely going forward with our fighting forces.
You know, what I see here for the future, though, is that I'll see the ratio of manned versus unmanned will start to shift. Now, the one thing I will highlight, our unmanned platforms actually still require quite a bit of manpower to operate. But the goal here is actually, as we get further down the path of technology, the less manpower to do this. And if we can do, one of the things we've been talking about is kind of the manned-unmanned teaming. And you may have heard the term loyal wingman, where you have a manned aircraft, then has a number of unmanned aircraft that support, that can either be carry additional weapons, be additional sensors, be decoys doing electronic warfare. And so that's an aspect of this. The other thing we're looking at is what can we do with some of these unmanned systems so they're not runway dependent. And so you have the flexibility to launch them from different locations. And then, ideally visionary, you could meet in the air with a airplane and then have a strike package that has all the capability you need. And there may be just instead of a number of manned platforms, it's one manned platform with X number of unmanned platforms that are all working together. And with the right sensors, with a good mesh network, then you're being able to share information and the right algorithms with the artificial intelligence. You can actually maximize or multiply your capability with that one manned aircraft.
We have a question about the Russians. Just last week, of course, our forces, 11th Air Force, NORAD, up in Alaska, Elmendorf Air Force Base, intercepted yet again Russian bombers and surveillance planes. And the question is, what is the purpose? Why are the Russians coming back into the airspace near Alaska and near the homeland? What are they trying to do?
I would say it's messaging. And we actually fly in different areas as well, and we are also sending messages that we have the capability to assure and deter. And there's times that various countries, the Russians in particular, will do things to message. I see it in the various jobs I've held both in Europe, in the Middle East, in the Pacific, where they will do things and sometimes be a little more. Not as safe and professional that kind of the international aspects of when you're doing intercepts and those kinds of things. And they do that sometimes to send a message. You can kind of tell sometimes where they're maybe not happy that either something we said did. There's an aspect of that. And that's why you may see an increase in certain times where we as a nation may have done something. Or said something, or a negotiation that's going on in the diplomatic sector has not gone as well as they hoped, and there's a way to maybe send a message back to us. And so that's the broader aspect of this whole of government to realize that it's not each event's probably not an individual event. It's interconnected to something else. And that's the part of deepening your understanding so you have an understanding of, there may be a catalyst there that we may have pushed a button that causes a reaction, and vice versa.
And we should note that the Russians were met by our F-22 Raptors.
Exactly.
Over the Pacific waters, the northern Pacific waters, as they do each time. We have a question from John, which is about the status of the nuclear triad today and the readiness to deter. And we're undergoing a modernization program. Maybe you could tell us a little bit your vision of the triad overall. Of course, the Air Force has two parts of that, and the status of the next generation bomber.
Sure. Well, matter of fact, that's exactly why I'm here at Vandenberg, is to take a look at our Minuteman III ICBM and walk through that mission set. I was supposed to observe a missile launch last night, but of course, unfortunately, due to weather, it did not go. But to have a chance to talk to the airmen that were doing this, these three lieutenants that were part of the actual launch crew, in addition to all the airmen that are involved and also some of our civilian personnel that are helping through this process. So what I would tell you is I'm confident in our ability to be safe, secure, and reliable, and be the strategic deterrent that our nation requires. So bottom line. But we also need to take a look at the systems that we have, and they've been around for a while. And the parts of that triad include this Minuteman III, which has been around since the 1970s, the B-52 that has been around since the late 50s. And they're still secure, they're still reliable, and they still get the job done. And so that's good. But we need to look at the future about how we modernize, which is why as you look at the B-21 and how that's coming along at the same time, as we look at the ground-based strategic deterrent, GBSD, and part of this trip, I'm going out to Hill Air Force Base later this afternoon, actually, to take a look at that program. So I have a better understanding of how we are our triad. And then the last part of that is also how we communicate. The nuclear command and control is a key aspect of this as well. And so we're making, I feel confident, we're making progress. We need to modernize so we can make sure our strategic deterrent remains safe, secure, and reliable when the nation calls upon it.
And you mentioned the B-52. I believe the last B-52 rolled off the line in 1962, if I remember correctly, one of the H models. And your plan currently is to fly them to 2040 or beyond with changes to the avionics, and yet the airframe is still viable.
You know that's the thing about when things are built back in the 50s and 60s, I mean, they were built solid. And, you know, the fact that, they set alert for a good portion of the Cold War doesn't mean they have as many flight hours on them. But that's the thing, as I was talking to folks yesterday about these Minuteman IIIs, they're pretty reliable because they were built pretty solid back then. A little more complex, as we move to the future and having airmen work on them because, our airmen are, those systems are probably twice as old as they are. In some cases, if not more, but it's really amazing how well those platforms are built. And the key part of this is if we take care of them, which that's our responsibility, then they will help us into the future. But at some point, you've got to make the shift from your, as I would say, to your antique car to the new car. In this case, the older platform into a newer platform, and that's something we are going to work with the Department of Defense on how we do our nuclear modernization.
Well, speaking of that, we have a question from Lawrence about moving to the new car. With the computer skills demonstrated by our adversaries, how are you protecting the Air Force's tech developments?
Well, this is part of the aspect of as we do and work with our industry partners is the cybersecurity, not only what we do internal to the Air Force, but as we're working with the industry partners, it's their cybersecurity as well, because that could be the soft underbelly of where our tech, particularly their tech that's supporting the Department of Defense, could be at risk. And so that's an important aspect of as we start to work with our industry partners, we actually lay out, hey, here's some things you get from a cybersecurity standpoint in order to work with the Air Force. There's some basic standards we all have to live up to protect the technology that's all important to our national security. So we're making pretty good progress there. I think many of us realize the fact of how our information is at risk, whether it's our personal information or it's our information for our technology to associate with our national security. We've all got to be paying attention to how we share, how we store information, and not and a lot of it has to be with just good basic hygiene about how we do things, because we as individuals sometimes can be the kind of the loophole that allows the lapse in cybersecurity, no matter how good the tool is to protect our cyber.
Well, sticking with the digital side of this for just a second, we have another question about what is the main interface between the Air Force and Silicon Valley? Is it Defense Innovation Unit? Is it something different? How does AFWERX fit into that? How do you interact with all of these different groups that are out there?
Well, DIU is one of those, but there's DIU, there's AFWERX, and then in different parts of our Air Force, we have different works. You know, Air Force Global Strike Command has Strike Works. We had Aloha Spark in Hawaii. And so we have a lot of innovative airmen that are reaching out in different companies and finding these companies to go, you know, they have a concept, they have an idea, and they're able to go do their own research and find out that there's a company out there, whether it's in Silicon Valley or some other part of the nation, that actually has a capability that kind of matches up what they're looking for. And it's really bringing in, AFWERX has what they call collaborator, I think the term's right, is collaboration events, where they basically say they bring in outside industry, we bring in airmen that are looking for, they have some ideas. It's really a place for them to meet and then start to build those relationships. They're called collider events. I'm sorry. It's but collider events where you bring, you know, kind of the collision of, I have a need, I have a capability, and you know, I joke, it's they may have an app for that. That's the kind of the concept of how we're able to do this in building those relationships. One of the challenges I think we do have then is how we get some of these and then scale that capability. And we have to do things differently in some cases from how we do our traditional acquisition programs, because those can be, they take a little more time, it's a little more bureaucratic, but there's other things we do at a lower level. And we have some authority to do that, and that's the thing we want to be able to take advantage of. And we're able to do that. Part of what I want to be able to do here, though, is actually we got to incentivize not only industry, but ourselves on how we operate. And then the other aspect, a lot of this, number of our airmen are doing this as kind of their night job, like versus their day job. And so what I want to do is put more people that do this as a day job. So it's going to drive us to move some manpower around to be able to do that. So we have the, but I want to keep them from getting very bureaucratic and becoming, you know, the big machine. And so we can make those connections and move. This is all about accelerated change.
Which certainly is how Silicon Valley views itself in terms of being disruptive and being fast. Actually, could we talk just for a second about the health of the force? First of all, everyone knows that our military is the greatest in the world because of our NCO Corps, because of the men and women who serve and have been doing so under extraordinarily trying conditions, you know, for 20 years now. The Air Force itself essentially being deployed and at war for over 30 years at this point. How do you see keeping the force healthy? There have been problems, there was a cheating scandal with the nuclear forces. There have always, of course, our senior officers that are transgress in different ways and feel pressures and are removed from command. How are you dealing with this as we transition into what may be an extended competition with peer and near peer competitors?
Yeah. Well, so Micah, you know, kind of a supporting part to Accelerate Change or Lose, which was the why we need to change. I also put out some action orders of what we need to change. And it was A, B, C, D, airmen, bureaucracy, competition, and design implementation. And so action order A is airmen. And the key aspect of this to your question is, how do we develop our future leaders? How do we develop the leaders we have today to make them better leaders, and how we develop our future leaders? And really what I wanted to do is create the environment where all can reach their full potential. You know, all airmen and all families can reach their full potential. Part of that key aspect there is also setting expectations, what right looks like. What we expect from our airmen, so we don't have cheating scandals, or we don't have transgressions. That's an aspect of building that right environment. I think the other piece, because as you highlighted, because of the conflicts we've been involved in, I also think about how we're dealing with COVID and the stressors there, the stressors of deployments, all of that, is how do we develop our leaders so they are better in tune into how to understand when someone needs help or is having a bad day. And if you don't know the people that work for you, it's kind of, you know, you can't tell a good day from a bad day. And so this key aspect is, you know, how do we better engage and build those leaders? And then also give them the tools that, you know, as a leader, you can kind of handle some of this on your own, because invariably we tend to kind of kick it up to the next level. And, you know, I'm not in a position where I can say from the Pentagon, here's what the entire Air Force needs to do. Yeah, so my goal here is to provide the intent of what we need to do and give them the authority and the tools. And each location, each situation, it's just a little bit different. And then allow the leaders to be leaders and allow them to actually figure out how best to take, given the intent I've laid out, the authorities they've been given and the tools that they have available to them, how can they best handle this problem? At the same time, there's a communication that if there's a tool or authority they don't have, tell me. And my goal here is to try to put it in their hands to the best of my ability to allow them to be able to better lead so we can take the stress off of our airmen, take the stress off our families. And because I talk about quality of service and quality of life, you know, to make sure that our airmen, you know, appreciate the jobs that they're doing, enjoy coming to work each day, contributing to our national security, and the quality of life is how we take care of them and their off time and take care of their families as they move around in support of our national security.
Thank you. We have a number of questions on the Space Force from Russ and some others. Russ asks, how do you feel about Space Force spinning off? We have another question about how the Space Force and the Air Force will, in essence, divide up responsibilities for orbital threats. How is that going to work? And again, to remind the audience, the Space Force is not an independent department. It's still under the Department of the Air Force. There are now two forces, Air Force and Space Force. So maybe you could tell us a little bit, both how you feel about having a Space Force, but also how you'll be working together with them.
For having a Space Force, I think it's good. It's a great thing to have the Space Force, partly for a couple of reasons. Part of the first reason is how we've actually operate nationally in space has been typically, we hadn't talked about. It's been a benign environment by and large, and we all depend on space. Matter of fact, we're able to do what we're doing right now because of space. And so from that aspect, but it, you know, our adversaries and others now have actually taken a look at space from a different area, and we look at it now as a warfighting domain, and partly because we need to be able to protect the capabilities that allow us to do what we're doing today. The other aspect of this is because of many of that, not so much of that had been classified, we didn't talk about it. So you had no idea what really was going on. You just, you know, as long as you had good cell coverage and your maps work, you go, what's the issue? Well, because of that stand up of the Space Force, it really increased the dialogue of what goes on in space. It brings down the classification level. So even I know, have a better sense of kind of what's going on. And so from that aspect, it's good. And it's also, we can highlight the things that are maybe a little more nefarious, because there aren't kind of the rules of the road that you would have in like we have in the air, heavy in the maritime environment, it doesn't necessarily exist in space. And so that's an aspect to drive that dialogue. I was going to say, to answer your question on the threats in the world, this is a key aspect of, as the Space Force stands up, and I work with General Raymond, is for the two of us to decide and work through what things does the Space Force do, and then what does the Air Force do? Because I don't want to have a gap or a seam, and then I don't want to be stepping on his toes and vice versa. So we're complete support. And I think there's really good dialogue. I've known General Raymond since we were majors. We went to Air Command and Staff College together. And there's really good value in the Space Force to have us focus on that particular domain.
Thank you. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. I know we have a lot more questions. I'm sorry we couldn't get to all of them. We could continue talking about this, especially on the tech angle and the China angle, for a long time. And there's no one better, sir, than to talk about it with you. We'd like to thank you for your time, for your service, for everything that our Air Force and airmen do in terms of maintaining stability and security around the world. To our audience, we'd like to thank you for joining us. You can learn more about this series at hoover.org/Capital Conversations. Thank you for joining us today. Sir, I hope we'll be able to welcome you back at some point. And to our audience, I hope you'll tune in next time. Thank you.